Well, the late Studs Terkel has been described as the 20th century's greatest listener. And during a lifetime on radio, he interviewed a who's who of America. But it's his interviews with ordinary working people that he's best known for. Shortly, we'll hear from Alan Weeder, the author of a new biography of Studs. But first, let's hear a bit from the man himself.
What has happened to the human voice? Vox humana. Hollering, shouting, quiet, talking, buzz. I was leaving the airport. This is in Atlanta. You know, you leave the gate, you take a train that took you to the concourse of your choice, and I get into this train, dead silence, few people seated, all standing. Up above you hear a voice that once was a human voice, but no longer. Now it talks like a machine. Concourse 1, Fort Worth, Dallas, Lubbock, that kind of voice. Just then the doors are about to close, pneumatic doors, when a young couple rush in and push open the doors and get in. Without missing a beat, that voice above says, because of late entry, we delayed 30 seconds. The people looked at that couple, as if that couple had just committed mass murder, you know. And the couple is shrinking like this, you know. And I'm known for my talking. I'm Gabby. And so I say, George Orwell, your time has come and gone. I expect a laugh. Dead silence. And now they look at me. And I'm with the couple, the three of us, at the Hill of Calvary on Good Friday. And then I say, my God, where's the human voice? And just then there's a little baby. Maybe the baby's about a year old or something. And I say, sir or madam, to the baby. What is your opinion of the human species? Well, what does a baby do? And the baby starts giggling. I say, thank God, the sound of a human voice.
Studs Terkel there speaking out on what has been lost in modern life and where he sees hope for our future. The great oral historian, writer, TV and radio host called America's Greatest Listener. And he changed the way we listen into who. Studs Terkel's groundbreaking work in oral history made it the new journalism, a people's journalism. Although he interviewed many famous people, Martin Luther King, Mahalia Jackson, Bob Dylan, Studs believes that every life had a right to be celebrated and recorded. And he did so through epic books such as the classic Working or the Pulitzer Prize winning The Good War. Now, a book has come out honouring his work, Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, but mostly Conversation. New York oral historian Alan Weeder interviewed many people about how Terkel's work influenced them. And apologies for the crackly line.
So that obviously connects to me deciding to write the book. So I was a doctoral student in the late 1970s, and oral history wasn't very valued in universities. And Studs' writing had begun. You know, he didn't have a book published really as an oral history until he was 57 years old. He'd been a radio guy, and he still was when he started writing. And I think I was really lucky. I think that the people that happened to be on my doctoral committee liked Studs' work. So it gave it credence. And that snowballed through my whole life as an academic. I haven't been an academic for a while now, but it allowed me to do the work that I did. So I feel, in a sense, this book is an homage. It's a debt to pay to Studs Terkel.
He was described, wasn't he, as one of the greatest listeners of the 20th century. What was special about Studs Terkel and the way he interviewed people, and what made him such a great listener?
I think that's the perfect question, and I think it goes with the title of But Mostly Conversation. The one caveat to that, of course, is that he also talked constantly. But once he was in an interview, he was an amazing listener, and I think it had to do with his belief that there was always wisdom in the room. And his room was very big. It could be the bus that he rode every day to the radio station that he worked at, WFMT. It could be the corner grocery store. It could be the petrol station. Wherever he was, he believed that people had something to say. And that's what he did when he did his radio interviews. I mean, so many authors talked about getting to his show and how prepared he was, and how it was like no other interview they had ever had. People would say, I came with my book, Chicago was the last trip on a book tour. I wanted to be home. And then he'd come out with the book, and everything was underlined. And he'd ask a question about a certain page, and he'd say, you have this insight. And do you know what an amazing insight this is? And the author often said he didn't know it was such an insight. But then they would talk about it, and they would realize things about their own work that they didn't even realize that they had done. And Studs had a way of really doing it. He was affected by Jacob Bronowski's concept of impertinent questions, but you had to ask real questions and have real conversation in order to get answers that have substance and meaning.
Yeah, extraordinary interviewer. And I think he said somewhere, Alan, that the most important question for him was, and what happened then?
Yeah, and he did that. And part of it had to do with having a great respect for who he was talking to. I mean, one of his mantras was, I wanted people to talk about what they wanted to talk about or not talk about what they didn't want to talk about. He had a real division between, there were certain spaces where he wouldn't go. He didn't try to get people to get into people's personal space. He didn't try to get into their family life. He didn't try to get into their things that were private. But the things that were public were so broad and so diverse, and it didn't matter if he was interviewing an opera star or the guy that parked cars in downtown Chicago, or an author, or Stokely Carmichael, or James Cameron. It didn't matter who he was interviewing. It was always that same respect and trying to take the person himself and all of us who listen somewhere further in an understanding of people in their lives. Mm.
I mean, it's quite standard practice these days, Alan, to archive and record the voices, from the streets, I suppose you could say, these days. But it must have been certainly quite groundbreaking back then, looking at people around you, the corner grocery store, the police, a man or woman, or a local person who works for the garbage truck, company, and actually ask them about their lives, what they do, and be genuinely interested. It must have been quite groundbreaking.
Yeah, I think it was, and I think just even visually, when you see photographs of him talking to people in different places and on the streets, and he's always carrying this gigantic German tape recorder that you'd have to have back surgery after you did it, right? And there's some amazing on the street interviews. He did a special once, and he interviewed children and youth that lived in government project buildings in Chicago. He was interviewing an 11-year-old child, and he said to her, well, what do you think you're going to do when you get older? And she said, what makes you think I am going to get older? We don't know that that's going to happen. And these things came out of people that he said Circle liked to be amazed. And I think that was part of his ability to get people to talk. And he amazed people, too, but he liked to be amazed. And people that started to hear interviews, of course, always were happy when he would ask them or other people would ask him if they could talk with him.
I'm talking with historian Alan Weeder on the work and life of Studs Terkel, the great oral historian, actor, writer. And I came to his work through an extraordinary book that was lent to me. And it was called, simply it was called Working, which I love the title, but the subtitle of it was, People Talk About What They Do All Day and How They Feel About What They Do. And here you had stories from, a sanitation truck driver, a garbage man, a washroom attendant, a factory mechanic, a domestic worker. And there's a piece here from Reno Robinson, he's a policeman, quoting, I worked in a white area on the west side. Briefly, being black in plain clothes, people might mistake me for a burglar and shoot me. It's better for me to be in a black area. Of course, people couldn't mistake me there, laughing. Very few black officers work in white areas. They have a few so they can say, no longer are we segregated. And it was really fascinating stuff. And you really got the feeling, Alan, that you're kind of eavesdropping into a personal conversation.
Yeah, and I love that you put it that way. That's absolutely the way to think about it. And I know when he had his radio show, originally interviews weren't a big part of the show, and somebody wrote him a letter. And you know, it's very funny when you do research for a book like this, because you spend a lot of time in archives, hopefully more time interviewing people just like Studs did. But every so often in the archives, you find a gem, and there was this letter that a woman had written him in the 1950s saying, "You just did these two interviews. They were absolutely spectacular. Why don't you do this all the time? I felt like I was listening to you and your friends having a conversation." So it touches what you just said. Many, many people think that Working was his finest book. It was a great book, and it touched so many people. And actually, I can't remember what's number one, but Working is now number two used in schools around the world as plays, because it was turned into a play.
Yeah, well, to those who haven't read Working this morning, this Sunday morning, I highly recommend it. Working by Studs Terkel. And he had this ability too, didn't he, Alan, to, I suppose, interview people who, well, you wouldn't have heard their voices in other sort of sectors. For example, there was a very, very moving interview in American Dreams of a poor white member of the Ku Klux Klan, C.P. Ellis, about how the only people who accepted him were the KKK, and having the need to have an enemy. It was quite weirdly affecting. And, you know, only Studs could have done that type of interview in that type of way.
Yeah, I think actually the way that you said that is absolutely perfect. He is the one person that was able to do that. And he was taken by people's lives. So actually, C.P. Ellis, which he often referred to as his most important interview, and it should be plural because he talked to him a number of times. But before that, he had interviewed another Klansman who was also viewed himself as a neo-Nazi, and he was a cab driver in Chicago. And Studs said during the interview and after the interview, he felt so bad about this man who said the same thing as C.P. Ellis about, "That was the only place I found my identity. It was the only place that people cared about me." Studs often said that the foundation, or one of the foundations for his work, was the British filmmaker Dennis Mitchell, who looked to tell the hurts of human beings. And the beauty of the C.P. Ellis interview was Studs loved transformation stories. Those amazed him the most. He loved to talk to people who had changed their lives, who surprised him. And C.P. Ellis, to continue about what Studs talked to him about, he was a member of the Klan. He worked in a petrol station. He thought people looked down upon him, and the Klan gave him that. But because his kid was in a school that was integrated, an elementary school, he volunteered to be on a committee that was formed at the school, and he was nominated as the chairman of this committee to make it a better school. And the co-chairman was a woman named Ann Atwater, who was the leader of the NAACP, the National Advancement of Colored People, it was called at the time, in North Carolina, and they hated each other. They fought at these meetings until they realized that they both wanted the same things for their children. And then they became allies. And then they worked together. C.P. Ellis went from being a Klansman to a union leader as well as a civil rights activist in North Carolina.
Good heavens. Studs Terkel, he was wedded to his hometown, wasn't he? He was wedded to Chicago, deeply impacted by the city of Chicago, and vice versa. And in a way, he was kind of a megaphone, wasn't he, for Chicago musicians, artists, writers, and everyday people. And of course, Chicago was, you know, the birthplace of May Day, the 8-hour day. How did Chicago influence Studs Terkel?
Yeah, I think it's important to note, as some of his friends like to tease him about, that he was actually born in New York City and moved to Chicago when he was 12 years old. So that would have been in 1924. And he immediately, the things that affected him in life were so close to what you just talked about, to the Wobblies, to other union people, to left politics. So he used to, his parents ran a men's hotel, and it was a place for working men until the Great Depression hit. And when the Great Depression hit, it became a place for men who weren't working for a short time until it closed. And Studs used to listen to these people have conversations and debate in the lobby of his parents' hotel. And he would listen to Eugene Debs on the radio with his father. His father was a big Eugene Debs fan. And then he would attend, there was a place called Bughouse Square that Studs compared to Hyde Park in London. And it was political speeches, it was religious speeches, it was anti-political speeches, it was crazy speeches, it was everything. But that's where he seemed to learn the importance of conversation and debate, and that it had to get to real issues. It wasn't just talk for the sake of talk. And actually, he became a political figure throughout his entire life, right up to his last days. He was involved in left political actions and also documentation.
Chicago, Alan, was also the most racially segregated city in the northern U.S., and I'm just wondering how it affected him, because the other book I read of Studs Terkel was that book, Race. And when I'm reading this book, decades old, what's happening in the US now is so, so pertinent to what Studs Terkel wrote and interviewed so many years ago. How did the issue of race affect Studs?
Yeah, and I think it was from the time he was a student at the University of Chicago. Every day I wake up and there's two things I wish I could hear Studs talking about. One, of course, is our insane presidential election. And the other is Chicago and police killings of black men and race relations in Chicago. But I think Studs, he was introduced to issues of race by one of his brothers. And he was sort of introduced to it through music. He had this list when he was in law school at the University of Chicago. You know, he was a law school graduate, and he passed the bar in Illinois, and he never practiced for one day. And he said the number one positive thing about going to law school was he stopped every day and went through the record shops on the south side of Chicago that were all black neighborhoods. And he learned about blues and he learned about jazz and he fell in love with it. And that took him on a political journey. So he became political. He and Paul Robeson, for example, worked very hard on the 1948 Progressive Party political campaign that obviously went about as far as all third party politics campaigns do in the United States. But for Henry Wallace's run for president, he became friends with Paul Robeson. And there were many, many other things, but there's three things that stand out about Studs Terkel, or four things that stand out about Studs Terkel and race. One was he was always very, very critical of the infamous Mayor Daley, but he was most critical on Daley about racism in the city of Chicago. And then the other time was two things that Studs did in 1963, because besides coming out and emceeing, giving talks at rallies and events, he documented racism in the United States. So and not just the United States. Let me do the international thing first. In 1963, Studs traveled to South Africa. And one of the things the book does, I think, that has done nowhere else is how involved he was in fighting and documenting white supremacy. So he went, in 1963, he went to South Africa. He struggled about going to South Africa. It was long before boycott, divestment, and sanctions, but there was something he thought wrong. And there was a German airline that asked him to come with four other journalists on their maiden flight between Frankfurt and Johannesburg. And he finally agreed to go. And when he was there, he, again, with this big tape recorder, he interviewed everyone. I mean, he interviewed black miners. He interviewed white people who loved apartheid. He interviewed white people that didn't love apartheid, but who knew that they benefited greatly from it. He interviewed the head of the ANC, Albert Luthuli, who had just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And that was a major thing because Albert Luthuli was under house arrest. Would be called that here, I guess. And he was banned in South African terms, and so he wasn't allowed to leave the house. And Studs got to him through Nadine Gordimer. And Nadine Gordimer met Studs, and she became sort of his guide in a very clandestine way to get to Attili. And he interviewed all these people and told in his own oral history way about apartheid. And probably the most powerful interview was an interview he did with a man who was supposed to help take care of him, to serve him at one of the game parks in South Africa. And the man introduced himself as John. And Studs, after a while, said, "So what's your name?" And the man looked at him like, "You know, are you ignorant? I told you my name is John." And Studs said, No, "What's your birth name?" And the interview with him became so powerful because he talked about his children and his hopes for his children in spite of the apartheid reality. So that was one thing. The other thing that he did in 1963 was he documented the March on Washington when Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. And he interviewed people. There were two trains that went from Chicago to Washington, D.C., and at the urging of his wife, Ida, who was much more political than Studs, he went with his recorder and he interviewed all these people who were so hopeful. But then he interviewed people on the ground in Washington that were very much against civil rights. And so he did both. He told these stories. And in fact, yourself and your listeners can listen to that series because it's in the public domain. It's called The Train. If you go to studsterkel.org, there's about 500 of his 5,500 interviews that are open to the public and can be used by other stations and other people. And all of them probably will be digitally online within the next 2 years. So it's a huge reservoir of wonderful interviews by Studs. And then finally, in terms of that, he did the same thing on the Selma to Montgomery March in 65. But to finish up on race, at the end of Studs' life, he received many honors. And he used to tease about it. He said, "How do you become a celebrity when your whole life is based on giving voice to the uncelebrated?" And he joked about that. But in 1999, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame for Writers of African Descent. And he is the only white person in that Hall of Fame. And when he was inducted, the leader of the Hall of Fame at the time, a man by the name of Hakeem Matabuti, when he inducted Studs, he said, "Studs Terkel is not biologically black, but he is psychologically and philosophically black." It was the one award. Studs was awarded by Bill Clinton when he was president. It was the one award that Studs treasured the most.
What do you think America's greatest listener, Studs Terkel, would make of America in 2016?
Yeah, when Studs died, he died 4 days before Obama was elected president. And when he first came upon Barack Obama, it was when he ran for Senate, and he loved him. He thought he was an intellectual. He thought that America didn't deserve such a person as president. By the time he ran for president and had been in the Senate, Studs' line was something like, "It's very important that we have a black president," and that was it. I think I can say something, but who knows, because Studs always surprised us. I think the main thing he would have been saying through this whole presidential campaign, he would have been talking about the supporters of Bernie Sanders, not so much Bernie Sanders. I think he would have been disappointed that Bernie Sanders didn't make an independent run after he lost the primaries. But I think he would have saw hope, because Studs always saw hope in the millions of followers, young people, that really do want change in the United States, and how do you get that going so that it actually becomes a movement? I have to think he would have been very, very critical of Hillary Clinton, but he might have actually, as we say here, held his nose and voted for her, because I think, like Noam Chomsky, he would have said, "There's one reason to vote, and it's called the Supreme Court in the United States." And I can't even predict what he would have said about Trump. I know it would have been humorous and serious all in one. You know, we've never had a candidate quite like that, like Donald Trump. But I know he would have had things to say, and I think it would have hurt his heart. Years ago, he did an interview, and he said, "I wake up, I watch the news, and I see no hope." Then I get on the bus and I start talking to people and I'm totally hopeful again. And I think that would have still followed, although I think it would have been a lot harder looking at Trump today. Hmm.
All about the great Chicagoan, America's greatest listener. The book, Studs Terkel, Politics, Culture, but Mostly Conversation, by historian Alan Weeder. Alan, it's great to have you on the show this morning.
Thanks. I had a great time.